Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. The story of Alauda Equiano is an extraordinary tale of suffering and triumph. This was a man whose 18th century life progressed from the horror of slavery to a position of literary and social respect in his adopted homeland of England. Kidnapped into bondage at the age of 10 in Nigeria, he would become an accomplished seaman and later an autobiographer whose principal work, The Interesting Narrative, became an inspiration to the abolitionists of late 18th century Britain. Happily, the book still survives and has been edited by Vincent Caretta. Vincent, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. I have wanted to talk to you ever since I came across this extraordinary book, and it's a book that I recommend to everyone, and I thank you for bringing it back to public attention. Vincent, Alauda Equiano was born about 1745, according to this account, in what we would now call Southeast Nigeria, and as I mentioned in the introduction, he was kidnapped into slavery at about age 10. That's an interesting thing in itself in the context of this book, because do we get from his sort of origins and his impressment into slavery and his later experiences insight into both classical patterns, classical African patterns of slavery, as well as the European varieties?
Well, this is often cited by historians, for example, because it's virtually the only account we have by an African of the Middle Passage. He doesn't say an awful lot about it, but he does depict the horrors of the Middle Passage. He does talk about becoming enslaved in Africa by fellow Africans. So it's also the only account we have of the intra-African slave trade by an enslaved African. And then, of course, once he gets to the West Indies, he talks about West Indian slavery. He compares it to American slavery. He also talks about white slavery that he encounters in the Mediterranean, the galley slaves in Italy, the enslavement of the Greeks by the Turks. Mm-hmm. So it's, my students, for example, find it extremely interesting that there's such a range of slavery, right, and that he clearly sees a kind of hierarchy of slavery. If you have to be a slave, it's best to be a slave in Africa or Britain. Mm-hmm. It's worse to be a slave in the West Indies or Georgia.
Before we go further, Vincent, I'd love to know from you, as a scholar, as an author, as someone who has lived with this and many other writings of its type, how reliable is the account that we're given here by Alauda Equiano?
That's a very interesting, complicated question to answer. One of the things that I decided to do when I started editing Equiano was to see, he's very circumstantial. He gives lots of particular dates and places. And no one had bothered to check to see, you know, whether he was reliable or not. And virtually every case that you can check with the document, he is reliable. It's really astounding how good his memory is. That makes all the more interesting to me the times where he's not reliable. Now, of course, we all have memory slippages. But he tells us that, as you mentioned, he was kidnapped when he had just turned 11. And he gives his birthday to 1745. And he says that he first came to England in the spring of 1757. Well, I've been able to establish that he first came to England in December of 1754, which is a significant difference. Because he says when he first came to England in 57, he could only speak African languages, the language of Africa, not English very well at all. But he could speak English very well. And he must have been kidnapped, if you look at the time he says they spent going from the inside of Africa to the coast and then across the Atlantic. He must have been kidnapped in, say, 1753, and which means that he was significantly younger than he says he was. Why might he do this? Well, I think the most likely reason is rhetorical. it's very important that he have the credibility of an African talking about what Africa was like, because the pro-slavery people had long argued that they were saving Africans from a brutal and horrible existence by enslaving them. And what Equiano wants to convince his readers of is that Africa was a good place to live, and that slavery was an evil thing. There was no salvation through slavery. And his credibility depends upon how old he was when he leaves Africa. So there's that very interesting gap. Once he is bought by Michael Henry Pascal, the lieutenant in the Royal Navy, we have documentary evidence. And he's, as I said before, he is astoundingly reliable. He would be so if he were, had been 11 or 12, even more so if he was 9 or younger.
You know, in that fine answer, you mention what is really, I think, the core of his tale, at least one of the longest chapters of his life, and that is his service at sea, his service in the British Navy, his first master, Michael Henry Pascal, a man of almost perverse cruelty in many ways, I thought, nonetheless introduced him to this form of life, and it became a kind of a ladder, and that's, I don't mean that cynically, because you know, the idea of a slave being able to elevate himself is perhaps unusual, but he was, because he became such an accomplished seaman. The question then, Vincent, is what kind of institution was the British military, particularly the British Navy, because it's, in American terms, almost unimaginable to think that this could have happened.
Well, actually, in America, too, there were quite a few black sailors, especially in the Navy, even more so than in the Army. Competence counts more than color. That, and this is something that Equiano discovered very quickly. He actually rose to the status, the rank of able seaman, which is the highest non-commissioned officer rank under Pascal. So that Equiano takes great pride in his service in the Navy. And it is, even though he's still young, he's legally a minor all through his naval service, he is recognized for his abilities. And afterwards, after he's out of the Navy, he takes particular pride in referring to instances where people recognized him as being in command of a vessel, right, even though he didn't officially have the status. He saves a vessel that he's on when it crashes on the Bahama Banks. He saves the crew. And after that, people, he tells us with great pride, referred to him as the captain.
Right. He did, in fact. That's an extraordinary passage in the book when that vessel founders. I mean, it reads like an adventure tale. And I also took him to be an extremely accomplished navigator, which is, a considerable skill. Is that right?
Right. It's a skill that the slavers tried very hard to keep Africans from gaining. He tells us in his first voyage across the Middle Passage, when he was first enslaved, that he was very intrigued by the white men's skill in getting the wind to cooperate, and they're using these instruments, and he succeeds eventually in getting, not on that cruise, but he eventually succeeds in getting white sailors to show him how to use the instruments so that he can navigate. And this is a very high order skill,
exactly,
even for a free sailor.
You know, I took him as the equivalent of a shipmaster in many ways, I mean, in terms of his capacity. And I think that's what I was thinking of in terms of, because you're quite right, there were an extraordinary, or at least a large number of blacks in the American Merchant Marine and the American Navy, even up including the Civil War. But I don't know if any of them achieved the kinds of, or many of them achieved the kinds of extremely high levels of skill. He could command a vessel, I thought.
Well, by the end of the 18th century, there was at least one black captain in the Royal Navy. We have to keep in mind that the British context is different from the American context. The Admiralty disapproved of slavery on British Royal Naval ships. So Equiano, for example, is never identified as a slave on the ship. And the British records never identify, I've looked at a lot of British naval records, they never identify the members of the crew by race, as we would call it, or color. Sometimes you can identify someone as probably black if the name is Cujo or Othello, for example. But Vasa is always listed as Gustavus Vasa. If you didn't know who he was, you would think, well, here's a Swede in the Navy. So the British, in some ways, it might have been easier to rise. Certainly, we don't get much sense of racial antagonism from Equiano's account. He talks about when Pascal reneges on his promise to give him freedom at the end of the Seven Years' War, and sells, rather than give him freedom, he sells him into West Indian slavery. Equiano tells us that his fellow crew members protested this, and this is we hear this over and over again if we read the accounts of the times, that the white laboring class, as we would call them, or the fellow seamen, sided with people like Equiano, not with the those who were trying to enslave them.
That is, Vincent, quite frankly, a wonderful answer. I mean, you added to the book in my mind and given us an insight into British culture of that era, and raised another question in my mind, which is this. In light of such circumstances, how African or how British would you say Olaudah Equiano Gustavus Vasa was? I mean, what kind of identity did this man have in the culture he inhabited?
That's a question that a lot of people get a lot of publications out of. You left out one, and that is African-American, and actually possibly two. He's also claimed by Caribbean literature. So what his identity was, he seems to me to see himself as what I call Afro-British. I use that rather than Afro-English, because British is more of a political term. Anyone can be British. Not anyone can be English, because that tends to be more of an ethnic term. For example, he tells us that he married an English woman at near the end of his life. And he means, of course, to let us know that she's a white woman. So I think that he chooses to live in Britain when he has the choice. Once he becomes free, he refers very early in his life to becoming almost an Englishman. He fights against slavery in Britain. He writes book reviews opposing slavery in Britain, in one of which he says that the answer to the racial antagonism in Britain is intermarriage. Not something that he would have been wise to have published in America at the time, since this was 1788 that he published that. So I think he clearly sees himself as British. At the end of his life, when he is appointed the commissary to the expedition to resettle Sierra Leone, he is certainly willing to go back to Africa, but by that time, his whole cultural and political heritage is British. He would be going as the highest official of African descent ever employed by the British government up to that point, because he was, in effect, going to be the ambassador, the representative of the British government to the local West African chieftains.
Let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston C.A., and my guest is Vincent Caretta, professor of English at the University of Maryland, and editor of The Interesting Narrative, published by Penguin Classics. Vincent, I want to ask you a question that may sound a bit odd in the context of talking about someone who, as you've just described, knew slavery in the initial portions of his life, knew freedom also, and sort of wrote from a very different perspective than an American counterpart might have written. But the question nonetheless is this: how would you characterize Olaudah Equiano's attitude towards slavery. And the reason I'm asking it is a complex one, because he does what he has to do in many circumstances, mm-hmm. and this is perfectly understandable. At one point, he's actually an overseer of slaves, as I understood it. And, well, what do you make of that?
Well, he is an overseer or a driver of slaves in 1776, when he and a former employer of his try to establish a plantation in Central America. And he takes pride in how humane he is as a slave driver. And he tells us that he's the one who picked out his countrymen when they're buying slaves for this plantation, which strikes most of us with horror and certainly disturbs my students. His attitude towards slavery is pretty complex, because we have to keep in mind that at this time, no one could name a period where slavery didn't exist. Slavery, in a sense, is a given. Even someone who's very steeped in the Bible, as Equiano is by this point, slavery is in the Old Testament, it's in the New Testament. There is no place where we are told slavery is evil, thou shalt not mm-hmm. enslave. We're never told that in the Bible, and he's very aware of that. And slavery seems to be, or was recognized as a normal, in the sense of always occurring as far as all history was known, at a social level. And the argument was more often about how does one treat the slaves, as opposed to whether slavery as an institution is evil. Increasingly, people are arguing against mm-hmm. slavery as an institution. His main point is to argue against the slave trade here. Mm-hmm. And when we say someone was an abolitionist in 18th century Britain, we're normally talking about someone who believes in the abolition of the slave trade, as opposed to an emancipationist. There were emancipationists. His friend Kwabena Atoba Kuguano, or John Stuart, his sometime collaborator on letters to the newspapers, was an emancipationist. And you could clearly see the difference, because Kuguano, in his Thoughts and Sentiments on the Evils of Slavery, which was published in 1787, argues that what the appropriate punishment for slave owners is to be enslaved by their former slaves. And that's as radical as you can get. Equiano never goes to that point. What he secretly felt about slavery, I suspect that he was opposed to slavery, but rhetorically he would have lost a lot of his audience. He's trying to move his audience with mm-hmm. him to at least the point of abolishing the slave trade.
Right. Important as this work is, and appreciative as I, as a reader, am of your fine editing of it, it's not the only book you've written, and it's not the end of your interest in this topic by any means. And so it's against that particular part of your background, Vincent Coretta, that I'm interested in where you would place Olaudah Equiano in terms of what we might call Afro-British literature, particularly of that period. I mean, first of all, how extensive a canon might that be? And secondly, what rank or quality would you give him in it?
Well, the question of whether there was a canon was one of the things that motivated me to start working on these authors. The easiest place to see the canon, and this sounds like self-promotion, I suppose it is.
Go ahead anyway.
I've published an anthology called Unchained Voices, an anthology of black authors in the English-speaking world of the 18th century, published by the University of Kentucky. And that includes 16 black authors before 1800 on both sides of the Atlantic, because as Equiano's own life indicates, it's very difficult to try to pin someone down to one side of the Atlantic or another, especially a slave or a former slave, most of whom originated in Africa, end up in America, and at least half of whom go to Britain or Canada, or a few of them ultimately go to Sierra Leone. So they're writing from Africa, ultimately. And the most, to Americans, the most widely recognized name would be Phyllis Wheatley.
Yes.
But to Equiano, as to Equiano's place in the canon, he recognized that there was a canon, for one thing. And this is clear from some of the names on the subscription list. For example, Kugawano's name is on the subscription list. I've just edited Kugawano's Thoughts and Sentiments on the Evil of Slavery for Penguin. He also has the name William, son of Ignatius Sancho. Ignatius Sancho was probably the most famous black writer in the 18th century, famous enough that Thomas Jefferson writes about him, giving him begrudging praise in Notes on the State of Virginia. And I've also edited the letters of the late Ignatius Sancho, an African, for Penguin. And Sancho and Wheatley were probably the best known literary figures. Equiano was the best known political writer, probably. He's not written about as much as the others because he was still alive, and you didn't want to take on Equiano, since people could see what saw from his book reviews what he would do. Mm-hmm. Thomas Jefferson safely writes about Phyllis Wheatley and Ignatius Sancho, both of whom were dead by the time he writes about them.
Let's talk about the end of Olaude Equiano's life, which ended on the 31st of March, 1797, mm-hmm. just a bit over 2 centuries ago. He married Susanna Cullen, I believe, an Englishwoman, as you mentioned earlier, and he left an estate of, in today's terms, I think about $120,000, which sounds awfully substantial. So what status had he attained by the close of his days?
Well, to put it in context, when he died, leaving that sum of money, or let's say when his daughter, surviving daughter, he had two daughters, only one survived infancy, when she inherited that, it was at a period when less than 5% of males, white males, had enough money or property to leave a will. So immediately we see that he was in a very small percentage. He's, as far as I know, the only Afro-Briton who's left a will at that period. I mean, it's the only one I know of. And so he achieved great status. He, throughout the book, is very concerned with his status. One of the reasons that he talks about his African background may be to try to justify the status that he believes he's earned in England. And in his will, he identifies himself as a gentleman. And now that term wasn't used the way we use it now, where you would say ladies and gentlemen to any group. Gentleman indicated a particular social class, someone who didn't need to work, for example, or who had the kind of position that was, we would call, very white collar. Mm-hmm. And so he's very careful to establish that he has earned this status. And so he is as high as any Afro-Briton has gotten. And of course, if we think of an American context, he's who would we compare him to?
I was just thinking that I don't really think you could establish a comparison. I mean, there would be later figures such as Frederick Douglass, mm-hmm. would get very eminent in their own way, mm-hmm. but to become a gentleman of property.
Well, in America, I guess the closest would be Benjamin Banneker.
Yes, perhaps. Yes, that's a good idea. It's a very good idea.
And Banneker was never a slave, though.
That's right.
So it wasn't the same kind of rise from mm-hmm. the lowest level to a more than simply middling level.
Well, Vincent Coretta, I have enjoyed this conversation very much as I did enjoy this book, which I recommend to all. And as we come to the conclusion of it, I know that your interest and involvement with Olaude Equiano continues. It is not merely a matter of this particular book or even of your scholarship. I understand you visit London with some frequency and are there involved with an Equiano Society.
Yes, there's an Equiano Society that was created by Arthur Torrington and Sam King, who are both of West Indian descent. Actually, they're both born in the West Indies, what we would call the West Indies, what they would call respectively Guyana and Jamaica. And they have been very active in promoting knowledge of Equiano. The British school system is planning to revise the canon, curriculum, in around the year 2000. And so they've been pushing hard to get writers like Equiano included in that. And I've gone over and I've given talks to communities, groups about Equiano, Cuguano, and Sancho. I was invited over to speak at the 200th commemoration of his death at St. Martin in the Fields, which was also a religious service presided over by the Bishop of Croydon, who is of Guyanese birth himself. So it's Equiano's become a boomlet industry.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And I do hope that that move to include his writings and the writings of others in the British curriculum flourishes. I think in today's multicultural Britain, mm-hmm. I think it's an extremely important thing to happen. Are there ways of keeping in touch with this or learning more about Olaudah Equiano in, well, this country and perhaps others as well, other than the book that you might suggest?
Well, there are a couple of web pages that I'm aware of. One is put out by Wilfred Samuels, the University of Utah, and he heads up the Equiano Foundation in this country. And another is the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, has a web page, an educational web page that they've put up.
Well, Vincent Coretta, let me express my deep thanks to you for being a guest today on Dialogue. And let me urge everyone to read Olaudah Equiano, The Interesting Narrative and Other Writings, published by Penguin Classics and edited by my guest, Vincent Coretta.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Vincent Coretta, professor of English at the University of Maryland and editor of The Interesting Narrative, published by Penguin Classics. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.